May I proceed?
May it please the court, Mr. Shell. This court has held that the usual sanction for misappropriation is disbarment because of the egregious nature of the misconduct. After consideration of mitigating and aggravating circumstances, informant believes that the appropriate sanction in this case is an indefinite suspension with leave to apply for reinstatement after 3 years.
Could we go back to the issue of whether this is misappropriation of funds?
If it's a misappropriation, Your Honor? Mm-hmm.
Because isn't it aiding and abetting an illegal contribution as opposed to a misappropriation of funds?
The charge to which the respondent pled guilty, a crucial element of that charge is misappropriation of funds. A second element of that charge is that it was willfully done. So that's the basis for which we charged in the information and the crime. This case, unlike other cases come before you, came up through Rule 5.21, which is a guilty plea.
And so
plea.
By pleading guilty, he admitted to those facts.
I think that's absolutely correct, Your Honor. He admitted to a misappropriation of funds from his client, and it was done willfully.
You don't suggest it was done for personal gain, though?
It was not done for personal gain, directly financial personal gain. I would not concede that the respondent wasn't doing something that he thought would place him in a better light with his client, but there was certainly no direct financial gain from his conduct. I might add that misappropriation such as this, it is a crucial element, and it was part of what the government negotiated with the respondent over in terms of what was pled guilty to and what the penalty assessed by the government was agreed to by the respondent. So yes, we do believe there was a misappropriation. In that regard, while he was requested to engage in this scheme by individuals within Missouri Employers Mutual, the client itself, operating through its board of directors, was unaware that the request had been made or that the contribution, in fact, had been made. So the client was unaware, and that's where I think the misappropriation comes in. Even though a member of the board made the request and the CEO was aware of the conduct, the client itself was unaware of the misappropriation.
And well, the CEO is aware. Isn't that the client?
Pardon me?
If the CEO is aware, isn't that the client? Don't they represent the client?
Under Rule 4-1.13, Your Honor, a corporate entity operates through its duly authorized constituents, which in this case, and in which any kind of corporate setting, would be the board of directors, not the CEO. The CEO certainly has day-to-day responsibilities, maybe delegated responsibilities by the board, but only to the extent that delegation occurs is that CEO acting as the client.
Because my sense would be the CEO would have the authority to spend $5,000 or $3,000, but maybe that issue is not.
Certainly not in the record that we have before us. Certainly not in the plea agreement between the respondent and the United States Attorney.
Well, CEO wouldn't have the authority to spend $5,000 illegally.
Correct. I mean, the Missouri Employers Mutual, as the client, was unaware that the request had been made or that the money had been spent in the manner in which it was.
And if everybody had known what was going on, there would have been no reason to misstate what the charge was on the bill.
I think that's right, Judge Wilson. Respondent makes the point in his brief that Missouri Employers Mutual could have made this donation themselves and wanted to avoid being asked by others for donations. And that may be the case. However, you didn't need to, in the invoice itself, say this was an advance of expenses. You could have said this was a contribution to the Democratic Party, and everyone would have been aware of it. So there was some element, I think, of additional hiding of the ball, so to speak, in that invoice.
It was an illegal, fraudulent act.
Clearly, that's what was pled to by the respondent. It is a misappropriation willfully done in violation of the federal misdemeanor statute.
How do you go about weighing discipline when the person who's being charged comes forward with lots of letters saying they're nice people, they're good people?
To me, Your Honor, that goes to mitigation. His reputation, his character goes to mitigation. In other words, in this case, I think you start with the baseline sanction that a willful misappropriation of funds There is ample case law that suggested that would support a disbarment. The ABA standards for imposing lawyer sanctions, section 4.11 and 5.11, support the fact that willful misappropriation of funds supports disbarment. Where do you go from there? Ultimately, you end up with studying or looking at aggravating and mitigating circumstances, which would either aggravate or lessen the sanction from the court. Clearly, there are several mitigators present here, one of those being character and reputation. I don't think there's any doubt that the respondent has good character and reputation. He has no prior disciplinary history. There are other mitigators that we point out. There was the imposition of the federal penalty, which under the ABA standards is actually a mitigator. He paid restitution, although it was as part of the plea agreement. So really what the ABA standards tell us is when you do it as part of a plea agreement, basically under duress, it's neither an aggravator or a mitigator. Nevertheless, we do recognize the fact that he made restitution. And there is a apparent absence of selfish motive, as pointed out. He didn't directly financially benefit from this misappropriation like some other cases might suggest.
But if the CEO of your client asks you to do something, you assume you do it, or are you going to end up not having the client?
Respectfully, I would say, Judge, that under the rules, Rule 4.-2.1, all of us as lawyers are required to exercise independent professional judgment.
But no, I'm not saying you shouldn't look behind it. I'm just saying as far as doing it, if someone asks you, who's the CEO, certainly you should look behind it and go to the board or do whatever else you think it's illegal. Shouldn't do an illegal act, but yeah, if the CEO asks you to do not an illegal act but something, you're probably going to do it if it's not illegal because...
Yeah, I just think that if you're asked to make this contribution and then bill us for it and just say advanced expenses, I don't know, that would raise a question in my mind.
Well, if he asked him to just spend his own $5,000 and give it to a political candidate, you know,
nothing wrong with that.
Right, but you do it because the CEO asks you generally.
Right, but then to bill it back to the client. In other words, if you're asked by the CEO,
no,
we want you to give $5,000.
I'm giving $5,000. I want you to give $5,000 too.
Absolutely. But people try. It probably happens all the time. But when you then say, by the way, we're the ones who want to make a contribution, just bill it back to us. Don't put it was a political contribution. Put that it was an advance of expenses. I think you're starting to engage in some questionable conduct.
Mr. Frenzel, I know you've asked for 3 years, and I think opposing counsel suggested 6 months. Is that correct?
Correct.
Can you address the appropriateness if this court were to impose 3 years or whatever period of time of it, that time period beginning at the time that he's voluntarily ceased practicing law per his agreement, plea agreement?
Sure, Judge Smith. Again, this is a situation, it's the second one I can think of, where we have an attorney who, through their negotiations with the U.S. attorney and the government, has agreed to a voluntary abstention from the practice of law. The other case you may recall was the Zink case, in which that occurred. And our view is that that is something that should be discouraged, should not be recognized by this court for the very reasons that the court said in the Zink case. Number one, that this court has the ultimate authority to decide what discipline should be imposed and to consider the ethical implications, the damage to the profession and the client that occurred as a result of that misconduct.
Is it different in this case because there was an interim suspension by this court?
Well, you know, that's the other thing that plays into this. To me, the U.S. attorney, that whole negotiation wasn't really necessary because as soon as he pled under 5.21A, we came up and asked for an interim suspension. So
that he consented to.
That's correct.
And when did that go into effect?
The actual interim suspension went into effect on July 3rd, 2012. He voluntarily abstained from the practice on April 13th. It is, to get back to your question, Judge Smith, we do not believe that he should be given the benefit of agreeing to an 18-month voluntary abstention and then come before you and say, well, because I only have about 6 months left on my voluntary abstention, you should only suspend me for 6 months,
which is what he's saying. So you're saying you should practice during that time, though?
To me, frankly, I had conversations with Respondent's Counsel, and I cautioned him about the Zink case and this voluntary abstention. To me, he could have just practiced right up till the date this court enters an order or until an interim suspension was entered and avoid this issue.
You're suggesting credit start when he actually, when we entered the interim suspension?
My view would be that he gets, he should be suspended, maybe credit from the date of the interim suspension. I could see that.
That's something we have control over.
Correct. That's correct, Your Honor. But by the same token, I think that this court's sanction analysis should look into all the factors that are mentioned in our brief. I don't think that just for his own accommodation, he should be given credit, which is basically would be the 6-month suspension they're asking for.
But you have a different purpose than the federal court. So it's like Don Anton. When Don Anton kidnapped John Frank, the federal courts, the U.S. attorney said, we're not going to prosecute you, so release John Frank. The circuit attorney, George Peet, said, that doesn't govern me.
And that's what you all said, and that's what the court said in the Zink case. And that's what's very important here is he got the benefit of his bargain in his negotiation with the U.S. attorney. He agreed because the U.S. attorney apparently insisted on it to an 18-month voluntary abstention. As a result, he was not prosecuted to the full extent that perhaps they could have prosecuted him. Are those factors that this court should be looking at? I say no. I think you need to look more at the damage to the client and, most importantly, in this case, the damage to lawyers as a profession that was done by this conduct. And by the way, how do we get to 3 years? I think we get from disbarment to 3 years by taking into account the aggravators and the mitigators that I mentioned, that were mentioned in our brief and that I've mentioned today. We have taken into account mitigating factors to reduce it to 3 years, because otherwise the willful misappropriation, in our view, would normally, and in this court's view from the Bells case, would normally call for a disbarment.
You didn't mention today in your mitigators, remorse and cooperation. Are those two factors that exist in this case?
I think he's remorseful, and I think he's cooperated. You know, it was part of his plea agreement that he cooperate, but I think he probably would have done that anyway.
So I think
they probably could be considered additional mitigators, Judge.
In the Bell case, he gave 3 years.
Bell's case was 3 years suspension. You're right, Judge. Thank you all.
May it please the court. My name is Matthew Shelp, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Ed Grzydek today. Your Honors, I believe the issue before this court, or at least our issue, is not that we dispute that a suspension is appropriate. I think that we are disputing the severity of the recommended sanction by the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel. As the court's aware, they're asking for a suspension, indefinite suspension, with leave to apply for 3 years. We respectfully request that, given the facts of this case, the unique circumstance, the mitigating circumstances that are present here, that frankly, that's just too much.
But you admit, you understand. You admit in federal court it was willful and it was misappropriation.
There's no question, Your Honor. In the federal court proceeding, which is in the record, the plea agreement's in the record, the charges in the record, Mr. Grzydek took full responsibility for his action.
When he pled guilty, did he understand that the ABA standards would recommend disbarment?
I'm sorry, Judge.
When he pled guilty to those things, did he understand that the ABA standards would be recommending disbarment?
I think that Mr. Grzydek's understanding was that he took responsibility for his actions. He certainly, in the criminal case, he certainly knew that there would be issues regarding the discipline that this court was considering. I think the Bells case points out that while a willful misappropriation, the starting point may be that it's appropriate for disbarment, what that case demonstrates is, with appropriate mitigation and with appropriate circumstances, that punishment can be lessened.
Mr. Grzydek is not claiming any kind of mental illness or any disability, as was claimed in the Belts case.
No, Your Honor, he's not. He's not. And again, as I think the record in the federal court is clear that he took responsibility for this.
So that's one mitigating factor. What other mitigating factors do you think there are?
Judge, I do think that there are several other mitigating factors. One of the things that the court addressed, and I think that's very important to this case, which is an easy one, is that Mr. Grzydek has been a practicing attorney in the state for over 25 years. And in those 25 years, he's had no disciplinary record or complaint filed with the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel. The court, or at least the arguments alluded to the fact that Mr. Grisadick was the attorney for MEM, and he realizes and he took responsibility for the fact that he may not have kept the entity's interests, or he did not keep the entity's interests above all. The chairman of the board of directors, Doug Morgan, the chief executive officer and president, Roger Wilson, the former governor of Missouri, came to him and asked about this plan to give a donation that was going to be at least informally credited, that's the way it was explained to him, to Roger Wilson. Obviously, from the record,
it is a crime to do what he did.
There's no question.
And I don't mean the crime of willful misappropriation. I mean it is a crime to make a political donation in this state and act like it was made by person A when it was made by person B.
There's no question about that, Judge. In fact, one of the mitigators, that would be a good segue, I believe, is that the Missouri Ethics Commission, Mr. Grisadick, cooperated with their action, entered into a consent order, paid a fine, and provided information that led to the amendment of those records before the state body. But there's absolutely no question that that is improper. It's a separate state misdemeanor, I believe, for a campaign contribution to be wrongfully associated with an individual or an entity when it really came from another source.
That was my question. The level of the crime is what?
That's a misdemeanor, I believe, Your Honor, in the state, yes. But when we're talking about willful misappropriation, and Mr. Grisadick is not trying to back away from the clear terms of his plea agreement, but I do think that there's mitigating factors within that willful misappropriation. As the court talked about, he was acting on behalf of, or at the request of, the chairman of the board of directors and the president and CEO of the company. Now, that's not to say that that makes it right, but what that's to say to the court is that is what, in part, led to Mr. Grisadick not appreciating the gravity of the actions that he took.
But and he was a lawyer for the...
He was a lawyer for the entity. Absolutely, Judge. He was a lawyer for the entity, and certainly, I think you pointed out, it's correct for him to potentially take direction from the chairman of the board of directors. It's correct for him to take direction from...
But not to do criminal acts.
No question. And he should have looked behind this transaction, because ultimately, and we don't dispute this, what this led to was a way, and this is why Roger Wilson also pled guilty in the case, this was a way for Roger Wilson to potentially make a political donation without reaching into his own pocket. That's what happened here, and we're not disputing that. The problem was is that Mr. Grisadick obviously agreed to do that, and that's what he did in the case. But what I'm trying to point out to the court is the lack of selfish motive is this wasn't a case where, in a lot of willful misappropriation case like the Bells case, where client's money was taken to line his own pockets or he was taking a cut of this donation. He made a stupid decision. There's no question about that. But the motive in terms of why he did that was not one of direct financial gain.
But you would concede there's some indirect.
No question. There's no question. And I think that that's something that probably was one of the things, unfortunately, that blinded him to that transaction. I mean,
there could have been indirect a calamity if he didn't. If he said to the chairman of the board and the chief executive, no, I won't do it.
Well, frankly, I think what Mr. Grisadick would say to that, you know, given the benefit of hindsight, is that's his role. He should have said no to that. I mean, there's no question about that. But what I'm trying to suggest is that how he got there, and those were powerful influencers, and the fact that he did this, which was wrong, but he didn't do this with the goal of directly benefiting him. And to answer your question, Your Honor, there's no question that he could curry favor with a client, and we all, as lawyers, try to do that, obviously within the confines of the law. Unfortunately, Mr. Grisadick crossed the line in this case. The question was asked about other mitigating factors, and one of the things I want to talk about is the cooperation with federal authorities. That's another piece of this. And certainly it is colored by the fact that he made a plea agreement and he was going to be charged with a crime. But Mr. Grisadick, went above and beyond just entering a guilty plea. He gave a full and complete accounting of this situation to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And in fact,
didn't they require that? What if he didn't do that?
He did not have to do that, Your Honor. And you can see that in the plea agreement, he'd offered to provide them assistance and be truthful with them, and he did do that. And in fact, as part of the sentencing in this case, they filed a motion under the federal sentencing guidelines, Section 5K2.1, where they asked that he
that they acknowledge and ask the judge to rule that he gave substantial assistance. And that's a motion that the federal prosecutors can make on their own accord independently. And that's the terms of the plea agreement. But that motion...
So he got the benefit of his bargain?
No, Your Honor. He did not get the benefit of the bargain in the sense that the federal prosecutors did not have to file that motion. It was only after reflecting on the extent of his cooperation that he provided that they chose to file that motion. And that's reflected in the plea agreement. And the aspects of that, in addition to what we've discussed, were that obviously he voluntarily entered the plea of guilty. He was awarded acceptance of responsibility. He was awarded the additional substantial assistance motion.
And what if he had gone to trial? What would have been the penalty?
If he would have gone to trial? In the federal criminal system, if you go to trial, potentially if you win, there is no penalty, obviously. But if you lose, the penalties are very substantial. They have a sentencing guideline system that awards points depending on the type of crime, the amount lost, and the whether or not the defendant has accepted responsibility. And so just on that alone, he would have risked additional points. So there's no question about that. He could have gotten three additional sentencing points. So there is a significant risk to him had he gone to trial, I think, to answer your question. And then some of this was already mentioned, but I think, again, it's what we're talking about here and what we're trying to impress upon the court is we don't disagree with the suspension. We don't disagree that there was misconduct. We just disagree with the severity of the recommended sanction. And I want to talk about that, 2 points on that. The court mentioned one factor we think is appropriate for the court to consider, and I don't want you to misconstrue me here. Mr. Griesinger got the benefit of his plea bargain, but the effect of that plea bargain was that he has been on the sidelines voluntarily since April 13, 2012. And to the extent the court would rule in my favor and say, you know what, 6 months is the appropriate time for him to be suspended with leave to apply, he's still not going to practice law under the terms of that plea agreement.
So how voluntary was this voluntarily agreeing did he tell the U.S. attorney, well, I will practice.
Yeah, and again,
part of the plea agreement.
And I don't want to dispute what the point I think you're trying to make, Judge. Is he got the benefit of that because obviously negotiating a plea agreement, that the benefit of him is in that case, and he got that. I guess it was voluntary in the sense of that he agreed to it, but it certainly was a part of. Hey, if this is going to be resolved in the way we're proposing, this is going to be a part of it.
How many months did he actually was he suspended?
Under the plea agreement, Your Honor?
No, under the 5.21. And the interim suspension?
Oh, the interim suspension began July 3rd. And so the difference between, if you will, the voluntary suspension, which, you know, arguably is involuntary as well, but that was April 13th, 2012. So we have May, June, and we almost get into July. So approximately 3 month difference between what he agreed to do in the plea agreement and what this court, the interim suspension order that he consented to, that was issued on July 3rd. And getting to the point I was trying to make is, the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel's recommended sanction, I think, I can't remember which judge pointed it out, but it doesn't make reference to whether either of those significant events and time should be considered at all when this court, if this court was to agree with him and levy a suspension with leave to file in 3 years. Was that to begin on July 3rd? Was that to begin on April 13th? Our position would be is that at a minimum, it should begin on July 3rd, as this court obviously suspended him with his consent, but that probably would have happened anyway. But I also think as a mitigator, he's done the real effect of that plea agreement is he's 53 years old. He's been a practicing lawyer for 26 years. He has an impeccable reputation and character up until this point, which he's taken responsibility for. He's lost his livelihood. And the fact that part of the federal case, part of the penalty, if you will, we would argue, would be that he's on the sidelines, and that began on April 13th, 2012. And we think that's appropriate for this court to consider when it decides what is the appropriate punishment it needs to levy in this case.
Now, I know that we have, obviously, the inherent authority to recommend when the suspension should begin and end, et cetera, but you said that he was going to voluntarily abide by the terms of the plea agreement, which was an 18-month suspension. So if he abides by that, when is the soonest he would go back to the practice of law, absent what we say?
So if we assumed that this disciplinary body wasn't involved in this case at all, and there was no proceeding before this court. The date that he would be eligible to return to the practice of law under the federal plea agreement would be October 13th, 2013.
And if we took your recommended sanction, then that would still be the date at which he would be able to return to practice.
Well, and I think that Mr. Pretzel correctly stated, we're certainly not trying to dictate or trying to imply or anything that we are somehow trying to bind this body. We acknowledge under Zink that you have the sole and complete authority. But what we're trying to say is that we're not necessarily saying that in and of itself, if we started, that this would be a six-month case. We are trying to fit it in the 18-month window that he negotiated with the federal government, because we think ultimately that however you construe it, the net effect of being on the sidelines for 18 months, given the conduct and the mitigating circumstances in this case, that that's an appropriate suspension, given all the mitigating factors that are in this case. But I want to be clear, and I don't dispute that Mr. Pretzel and I talked about it, and the plea agreement reflects that no party made some type of representation that's contrary to the Zink case, where we're trying to dictate anything to this court. I think I want to hit quickly on several of the cases cited in the Chief Disciplinary Counsel's brief where a three-year suspension, if you will, was given. We believe are far more aggravating than the factors here. And rather than spend a lot of the court's time, I'll just get to the conclusion, but I will point out that this is a case that was a willful misappropriation. We don't disagree with the facts that we entered a guilty plea to, but at the end of the day, it was $5,000 that the client, MEM, lost.
Did he ever go on the record in the allocution and say why he did it?
He did. Basically, the allocution was consistent with what I'm saying. I mean, you know, I followed the direction of the CEO. I followed the direction of the chairman of the board of directors. I was wrong. I have a higher obligation to look behind it, and I realize now that I facilitated the process by which my client's funds could have been used to benefit Roger Wilson. So, I mean, I don't know if that explains why. That's how it happened. Quickly, if I could, Your Honors, we believe that Mr. Grzydek's offense stands alone against a backdrop of service, dedication, and integrity. He certainly made a mistake here, but he requests that this court take into account his significant contributions to the Missouri Bar, to the citizens of Missouri. That's something we mentioned in our brief, and his otherwise unblemished record before this court. We think it's critical that the court assess that he, even though he did do wrong, there was an absence of selfish motives in this case. And when Mr. Grzydek respectfully requests that this court rule in his favor and grant a six-month suspension in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just a couple of points briefly. Judge Russell, you asked about his experience and lack of disciplinary history, and those are two factors. But they cut different ways. The lack of a disciplinary history, as well, we all know, is a mitigating factor. 25 years of experience in the law is actually an aggravating factor, because you're supposed to know better after you've been a lawyer for that long. So that does cut both ways. Mr. Shelton mentioned the lack of a selfish motive. And the only thing I would say in regard to that is that the ABA standards, if you look at standard 4.11 and 5.11 dealing with the misappropriation, there is no requirement that misappropriation be for the benefit of the attorney. It's the act of misappropriating funds that is the disbarable act. So the fact that he didn't directly financially benefit is of no recourse under the ABA standards.
Before he would rejoin the bar, would you require him to go to ethics school or do something else, or what would you do?
I apologize. Can you repeat that?
No, I'm just saying, before you would let him get back in the bar after 3 years, would you require him to go to ethics school or some other remunerative?
I don't think it's a case that really calls for attendance at ethics school, Your Honor. I don't think that the violation is such that ethics school doesn't address issues of character and fitness, frankly. And so I'd say no, that ethics school would not be something we would require. My final point is that I think giving credit for his bargain that he made with the U.S. attorney, a day-for-day credit, the fact that he went to them and said this is an 18-month abstention that I think is appropriate, and then comes to you and says, I think it's a 6-month suspension that's appropriate because I want to get back in October, on October 13th of 2013, is a bad precedent to set, and it's a bad policy. And the fact is that I think this court and our office, I know, looked at this independent of that bargain that he made with the U.S.
attorney. But the time he spent the interim suspension, you would give him credit for?
I think the interim suspension time is something that you can give credit for. I believe that's correct. But I just think it's bad precedent. And frankly, it's something I think the U.S. attorney shouldn't be doing. I think they should trust that we're going to be taking action in these cases and not require this, frankly, of criminal defendants. So unless there's other questions, I appreciate it.
Do they have any review mechanism? If he did practice in that 18 months, would they revoke his?
I think there's provisions in the plea agreement that would call for termination of the probation, certainly.
Okay.
Any other questions?
You're not aware of any case where a lawyer's pled guilty to a federal crime where we haven't entered an interim suspension, are you?
I'm not aware of any case like that, Your Honor. No. Thank you all for your patience.
Thank you. The case will be taken in submission.